so pleased to be able to present. Rosemary.
I can't get anything out of tonight.
Rosemary. I'm going to ban to set the microphones up.
Three or 4 weeks ago, I do remember running into you at a meeting, and you said, "It's been a year now. Are you ready yet?" And I was ready.
I was ready.
Before I start, I want to tell you that I wholeheartedly understand NABA's singleness of purpose. I wholeheartedly support it. But I must tell you that you've asked me to tell my story. And in order for me to tell my story, it's going to involve things other than just alcohol. Because I use many substances. So if that is going to go against your program, leave now and work on a resentment and then talk to me later on. Because I'm going to do the best I can. Shut up, Frank. Tell you my story. Frank's over there going, oh, no. With that being said, my name is Rosemary Rivers, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight. I look around and I see just tons of people that I know. They've been an integral part of my life in one way or another for a long time. I'm just the luckiest person in the world. I just still to this day, I always said, sometimes when she speaks, she gets emotional. Almost every time I speak, I get emotional. Because I still to this day don't get it.
My God chose me.
And because I really do believe we're chosen people. I really do. And I take that real serious. It's one thing that's kept me here for all these years, because it's the first time in my life I ever had a purpose. I never felt I had a purpose. And when I walk into these rooms and you explain to me, carrying the message and helping the alcoholics, little sufferers, suddenly a part of me filled up and I realized that I honestly God had a purpose.
It's past January.
I celebrated 25 years of continuous sobriety.
And in March, I celebrated 62 years of continuous life.
Now, I don't know why one has anything to do with the other, but trust me,
it does.
Number one, I never expected to achieve either one of them.
Well, she's actually the 62.
I just didn't think it would ever happen. He kept referring to it as a hardcore meeting. I don't know if it's hardcore, but I'm going to tell you right now, honey, I did not live my life knitting and listening to Jesus songs in the corner. So, I'm just going to tell you what happened. I was born and raised in a town south of here called Hampton. Many of you know that. The only thing it's famous for besides me is the racetrack. And it's certainly not famous because of me. I was born into a family that did not want me. And you're going to go, is he going to tell one of the big old victim stories? No, I'm going to tell you the truth. I was born in a family that did not want me. My mother did not want me. My father did not want me. My brother certainly didn't want me. And that would manifest itself all the way through the rest of my life, up until they left this earth. The resounding message I got was, you're not wanted. We didn't want you, and we don't know what to do with you day and night. I was a little country girl, lived on a dirt road. Didn't know anything about playing with little girls because there weren't any little girls to play with. We had cows and chickens and pigs and horses. And
my daddy was
what was called a weekend farmer. But he's also a major alcoholic. My father was a big alcoholic, and my mother was, oh my God, did she love prescription pills, Valium especially.
Every other
word out of her mouth is, they have a Valium, you'll feel better. The other thing that was true in my house was that there was not much love.
I never heard a nursery rhyme.
I never heard a children's book. Never. And when I grew up and started hearing those things, I thought, I don't remember any of that. Itsy bitsy spider would do what? I didn't know what any of that was, because that's not how I was raised.
Our house was cold.
That's the best way to put it. My father would get drunk starting on Thursdays. I was raised in a dry county.
And so he would get the
government liquor on the way home on Thursdays from work. And by Saturday, the government liquor would be gone, and then we'd be headed to the bootleggers. And at 3 years old, he started taking me with him. And at 3 years old is when I learned about sex, because while the bootlegger was going down the spill to get my daddy's gallon of liquor, my dad was having sex with the bootlegger's wife while I was sitting outside on the sofa listening to it.
I didn't really know what I was listening to,
but I knew something wasn't right. I just knew something wasn't right.
I thought
that wasn't the way it was supposed to go. My mother and dad fought like cats and dogs. They never hit each other. He was not one to hit somebody. But what I used to do as a little bitty girl, and I sometimes will do today, and I might do it tonight because I'm a little nervous. When all hell would break loose, I would get me a blanket, and I would put it over the coffee table. And I would get under the coffee table, and I would
whisper, and if you wanted to
come see me, you have to come under the blanket, because that's the only place I felt safe. Because all hell was breaking loose in the house. So sometimes when I speak, I put y'all under a blanket with me so that I'll feel safe telling you. I have an older brother. No sisters. My sexual molestation began at the age of 5.
And that will be more revealed about that.
But for many years, I said that lasted until I was 10.
But we'll get more honest with that as we go on.
I can't ever remember drinking not being a part of my life. My father drank all the time, and as early as I can remember, I was stealing it from him, and you know, just.
And no, I don't remember that first drink and that old warm feeling, and oh,
I fit in. It didn't matter how much I drank, no matter what I did, I never felt like I fit in anywhere. I was
somewhat of a disappointment.
You know, what mother doesn't want an old girl that wears little frilly dresses and old Mary Jane shoes and, you know, that ain't what she got. You know, she got a cowgirl that rode horses and fished and fed the cows, and that's just who I was. And that's what I liked to do, and that's what I did. I didn't know that there was anything different about me. Didn't know, because I didn't have anything compared to. School was uneventful. You know, I'm not one of those that goes in the first. When I go hear somebody speak and they start in the first grade, I think, God damn, we're going to be here a long time. Especially if they're an older person, but we're not going to do that. Elementary school was just exactly what it was. You know, I got off the bus, my dress was already torn, and I couldn't wait to pull it off so I could go out and do what I do, which was go fishing and ride horses. Already my mother was deciding there was something wasn't right about me, and was beginning to question it, and I didn't even know what she was questioning. I had no idea. All I did know was that one day I noticed I wanted to kiss Kathy Pendley, and I thought, I don't think that's right.
I don't think I was supposed to
kiss Kathy Pendley. But I didn't know what that meant either, and I didn't have anybody to talk to. So when you live in a little small town, you just don't talk, you know. And my family was one that everything looked great on the outside. My father was well thought of. My mother was well thought of. But I never had to spend the night coming. Folks never came to see us, and we never went to see other people. Because my dad not only was doing the bootlegger's wife, he was doing half the town of Hampton. And my mother knew it. And it was a consummate alibi. Just turned her head and acted like nothing was happening. So I grew up with some really screwy ideas about loyalty, about sex, about trust. And I brought those into my adult life with me.
High school
was incredibly uneventful. I just didn't feel, no matter how much of my booze my daddy's
that I would
steal on the weekends and
drink, I still didn't feel
like I fit in with them. I mean, that drugs and alcohol never did that for me. What it did do for me was,
if I drank and drugged
enough, it would get me to a point where I didn't think anything. I didn't feel anything, and that's what I was really wanting, was to not feel anything. Because the only thing I really felt was loneliness. All my life I can remember, I just wanted to be somebody. Now, I don't know exactly how to explain that, but, you know, I was very jealous of my brother. He was Mr. Everything. You know, he could play an instrument. He was doing this and he was doing that. And I felt like I couldn't do anything, and I just wanted to be somebody. And I thought,
if I could just be somebody,
that they'd notice me. My mama would like me then. My daddy would like me then.
That didn't seem to work out any different.
High school, again, I say
was uneventful. We didn't
have drugs when I was in school. I mean, shit, I graduated in 1966. That's
44 years ago.
There weren't no drugs that I'm aware of. we went and bought Tall Boys from Bootlegger, and whatever that liquor we could steal from our dad, and we smoked our cigarettes. And those are things that we did. You know, I wasn't popular. I wasn't unpopular. I just melted into the woodwork.
Just like I had all my life.
I just didn't exist. Just, I'm just here. I'm just breathing.
I can't even say I wasn't happy.
I don't really know what happy was. I was just getting through.
The best thing that ever happened was in 1966 when I graduated.
And I got a job in a field that I dearly loved, the wholesale sporting goods business, which girls were not in. There was no such thing as a girl. I was the first one in the Southeast United States, and I
loved it. Loved it.
I studied it like it was my folks didn't believe in girls going to college. Girls don't go to college. They get pregnant and have babies. That was not happening.
So I
got a job. And I remember making $60 a week.
And thought I was all that in a bag of chips.
Was it a buck and a quarter an hour now? But I mean, I thought I was. Hell, I had a job in Atlanta.
I live in Hampton.
Loved that industry. My brother, shortly during that time, at some point during that time, found God. Jesus. And
he was struck and called to the ministry.
And, oh God, it was something else. So I got called one day to the family table, and I was told this. I was 19. I was told,
you either give your life
to Jesus Christ, quit your sinful ways, or you'll have to leave this family.
And I said, bye. I'll see you later.
Gone.
And at 19, I left. And that was the last time I saw them until I was in my 40s.
I had nothing to do with them, and they had nothing to do with me. When I got to move to Atlanta, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I thought, here are my people. They're drinking, they're drugging, they're partying, they're doing all the kind of things I like to do with the people I like to do it with. And I didn't feel so
obvious anymore.
And when I was in Henry County, I felt like I stuck out like a sore thumb. I'm sure if I didn't, that was all in my head. My drinking had greatly increased.
And I always swore that I would never grow up to be
like my daddy. My daddy drank too much liquor and chased women. I grew up to be just exactly like him. And I swore I wouldn't do that. But that's what I did. I started off being a daily drinker, but back then in those days you got all what you did. You got off work, you went home, you took a shower, and you went to the bar. You stayed lit close. You got home.
You slept 2 hours.
You went to work. You got home. You took a shower. You went to the bar. I lived in a bar from 1972 until 1985. Every night of my life. I spent Easter there, Christmas Eve there, Mother's Day, Father's Day. I'm telling you, it's a sad sight
to be in the bar on Christmas Eve, you know.
We're all feeling so sorry for ourselves. But I was drinking
more and more and
more. I was beginning to extort money from my company because I couldn't support that party habit.
I mean, you don't have money to party.
And
I started throwing up blood, and I could
not for the life of me. I couldn't figure out what was wrong, so I went to the doctor, and they ran all these tests, and among the myriad of things he said I couldn't do anymore, he said, you can't drink. I said, okay. Never thought a thing about it. I thought, oh, okay. He said, I don't want to be this sick anymore. So I went to work, and 3 days later, after I had not had a drink, my shit was in the wind. I could not hold my hands still. I couldn't complete a sentence. I was a complete nervous wreck. I had no idea what was going on. I called a friend of mine, and she said, I'm coming to get you, and I'm going to take you to a place called The Link. I don't know if you know what that is, but anyway, it was a psychiatric place. Took me to The Link. This guy talks to me. He never one time asked me about my drinking. That's good. I didn't do any drugs. I didn't know anything. You know, drugs were terrible. Folks who did drugs were not good. And
so then he sends me over to Parkwood
to a psychiatrist by the name of what was that guy's name? I can't remember. Anderson. And he was one of those psychiatrists that did this. You go in to see him and you go blah 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 blah, and he go, mm-hmm.
How'd that make you feel? and you go blah, 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 and you go, mm-hmm. How'd that make you feel? That's all that son of a bitch said for a year. Mm-hmm. How'd that make you feel?
But here's one thing he did for me. He started writing prescriptions from day one. And from day one, I would take one and it wouldn't work. So I would think, well, I'll just take another. And that wouldn't work. And I would think, well, I'll just take another. And that wouldn't work. And after I'd take four, five, six,
it would work a little bit. But then all of a sudden my prescription would start to run out and I thought, what am I going to do? So I would go and tell Dr. Anderson,
you know, that drug's really not working. You need to try me on something else. So he put me on a different one. So from that year, I don't even know, Elevil, Trivil, Sonequin, Plastidil, Seconal, Tylenol, everything you can imagine. And I
took just as many as I could take.
And he,
believe it or not,
kept believing these stories. He had no idea that I was filling the prescription, taking half of it before I left the drugstore.
And that seemed to do for me
pretty good, because you know what? I didn't think about drinking. I could go to the bar that night and be as stupid as the rest of
them. But I wasn't drinking.
You know? And I thought, this is good. This is a good idea. Well, after a year of talking about my mother,
because that's what we talked about,
I went in one day and
probably had just a little bit too many drugs under my belt, and I said,
F you and my mother, I'm out of here.
And I left.
Didn't occur to me that once I left, the prescriptions would dry up. So I'm in pretty bad shape. I'm beginning to pick up the drink again, and a friend of mine says, you ever tried cocaine? I said, oh, God, no, that's a drug. And they said, no, I mean, really, have you never tried cocaine? I said, absolutely not. And they said, we're going to get some.
And I said,
by that time, I was pretty desperate. I said, okay.
They said, you want to go in half with it? I said, yeah.
How much is it? They said,
$75. I said, God damn, $75. This is in the early 70s, and I said, okay.
So I gave them my $37.50, and they gave me their $37.50, and they went to get it. And for those of you who know about that world, getting it is a
huge production,
and then you got to get the table ready
and all that shit done, and clean everything off. And I'm
looking at, I don't know what these people are doing. But here they come, walking back in the door, and I'm expecting them to bring something in the back of a Chevrolet truck for $75. They walk in the door,
and I don't see anything, and I'm like, where is it?
She said, wait a minute. She reached in her little watch pocket, and I came this little bitty thing, and I said, that's it? She said, yeah, that's a gram. Well, I don't have a sense of weights and measures. And I said,
that's a gram.
She said, yeah, here's half of it, yours. This is a day I should have known I was in trouble. I did not know if one granule of that stuff would rocket me off to the other world. I only knew one thing. That was not enough. Whatever it was, that was not enough. And therein lies the moral of my story. There was never enough. Never enough love, never enough attention, never enough alcohol, never enough drugs.
Never enough.
Till I walked in these rooms. That started my my drug usage. And because
I can consume copious amounts of things when I start to do them,
it became to be very expensive. And so I certainly was
extorting some money at that point.
So I finally decided to quit my job and become a drug dealer. Because I figured that out. I'm going to buy this shit also. I'll sell it to you, retail, and I will take the profit, and I want to pay for mine. Made perfect sense to me. So for 10 years, from the late 70s, so I walked through these rooms in 1985.
My sole source of income
was dealing drugs. And I do not say that with pride. And I do not say that in a boastful manner. Because I will tell you, that was
the darkest, sickest,
most despicable
period of my life.
I never would have believed that my life could have gone to the places that it went. In the beginning, it was really fun. You know, I had a partner, and he had Buckhead, and I had Midtown, and I had 35 people dealing for me, and I'd go out at night, pick up a pile of money, and I was being able to do all my drugs. I hadn't crossed that magical line. I was even starting to have a few cocktails again.
And life was great.
Money was flowing. In fact, I tell this a lot. We got so much money, we would put them in blue plate mayonnaise jars and
bury it out at Chastain Park.
I have been all over that fucking park. With a lot of different things looking. I cannot find it. I don't know where it is, but it's out there somewhere. I got really, really sick because my usage is just like y'all know, got to be way more than it should have been. And, you know, when it used to be two for you and one for me, it got to be one for you and three for me. The quality of what I was putting on the street was not good, and the quality of the people that I was associating with was certainly not good. I carried 238 Smith & Wessons because I dealt with some not very nice people. My partner, you may have heard of a couple that got murdered in 1983 up in Vinings. It was gangland. They put their two chairs together and they put duct tape around their eyes and they shot them in the temple. That was not supposed to have been her. That was supposed to have been me. She was his wife and had nothing to do with it. I get there an hour later and there's police everywhere and I'm like, what's going on? And they tell me. So,
I'm so sick.
You know, next thing I know, I'm being given a polygraph of the GBI. I've got people all over my behind, and because I've got more than one group thinking that I did it, and I didn't do it. So the advice the Cobb County Police gave me was to leave town that day. Leave. And I did. I left. I went to Florida. Was I a good girl?
Hell no. I slept back in Atlanta 3 times a night
a week and did business and went back to Florida again. I was getting
crazier and crazier and
crazier. I just had no care or concern for human life. I didn't care. I didn't care about you. I didn't care about me. I became a thief during that period. And you say, well, what are you stealing? You got all that money. I don't know. I think it was a cry for help. Because that was back in the days when you could get in the hood and you didn't have to latch it from the inside. So I'd be sitting at the bar and somebody say, I need a battery. I'd say, I'll be right back. What kind of car you got? I go steal somebody's battery out of the car. I jack up your car and take all four of your tires. Stole your lawn furniture off your patio. Stole your plants off your porch. And gave them away. I was doing Robin Hood. I don't know why. But I would steal anything that wasn't attached and then give it to everybody. I really think inside that was me saying, somebody, please stop me. Somebody stop me. I am crazy as a loon. Don't y'all know that? Stop me. Never got caught. Granted, we paid lots of money to Atlanta Police and other assorted folks, and that's all I'll say about that. But I think that I so desperately wanted to stop because I had gotten just terribly, terribly sick. Yes, I've been in those hotel rooms in Miami, and yes, I've seen those chainsaws, and no, I don't ever want to go back to that again. I was getting to a point where I was like a monster. I would go weeks without sleep. There was a bar in Atlanta called The Cove, and I can remember one Monday morning I had been partying for days and hadn't been asleep, and it was about 9:30, and I was hanging over the back wall watching the cars coming down the street, and I looked at my friend and I said, where are they all going? And he said, to work.
And I was the loneliest
I had ever felt in my whole
life. I thought, you're not even human. You're not
part of the human race anymore.
You're an animal.
You've turned into an animal. I wasn't throwing up blood anymore, and so the drinking was back.
I would do crazy things. I lived at Bordeaux apartments for a while.
I had been doing
a particular drug called MDA, which some of you may or may not know about.
But I had been doing it for quite a number of hours, and it took me about 3 hours to finally get my car out of the parking lot. And I was coming up
the highway, and
the police would stop me. And he came up, and I rolled the window down, and I said, yes, sir, was I speeding? He said, no, ma'am, you're doing 12 miles an hour. And I thought, I got to get home. I was gone.
I had no mind left. Had not seen my parents.
My father was one of 10 children, had not seen my aunts and uncles, didn't know my nieces and nephews. And they wanted nothing to do with me, and they knew nothing about my drugs or drinking, ever. My mother and father were never exposed to that. It was my lifestyle. I was going to hell. Well, I'm not. Anyway, you know, as
as luck would have it, and I say this is luck, I think that at some place I had a divine intervention for me. It came standing at the dumpster behind the Claremont Hotel on Ponce de Leon. I woke up at like 2 o'clock in the morning. I came to like my senses at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, is this what my life has come to? Because by that point, I'm begging people for money. I'm not the big shot dealer anymore. I'm begging for money. Now, I still got the big shot high rise up on Peachtree North, but I haven't paid the rent God knows when. I don't have any recall of October of 1984 until January of 1985. I don't know where I was.
Who I was with.
What I was doing.
I've been
told where I was. But I do know that when I got back to my apartment and I unlocked the door, the person that had been crazy enough to live with me had left. And I thought what I would do would be just end it all. That was not even an option. You know,
that wasn't an option.
So I went out on the patio, I was on the 7th floor, and I put one leg over, and I remember looking at the Fox
marquee.
And I got one leg over. I don't know if you know what hell is. But hell for me is when you can't live and you can't die. Because I couldn't put the other leg over. So I got off and I went inside and I made one phone call to the only one person on the face of the earth that was still talking to me. And I said, I need help. I had no idea what I was asking for. I didn't know what kind of help I needed.
It still had not sunk into me.
She then called somebody else,
and they then in turn
called somebody else,
and the next thing you know, I've got people in my apartment,
and they've got me over at Georgia Mental Health.
The next thing I know, I'm in back, and the next thing you know, I'm in St. Jude's Halfway House,
and here's what I had, the clothes on my back.
Because when I went back to get
my things from this beautiful Miami Vice high-rise, it was locked.
And this indignant me went down to the office and said,
well, why is my apartment locked? And they said,
you had to pay the rent for 5 months.
So they had destroyed everything that I owned or sold it. So I started January the 7th, 1985, with a pair of blue jeans, a sweatshirt, a pair of tennis shoes, and no coat. And I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm so glad I didn't have a 401k or a big old house or a two-car garage.
Because you know what? I wasn't very teachable.
I didn't think anybody cared enough about me to help me. So I was very distrusting. Very distrusting. And I think that God, in His infinite wisdom, said, Rosemary, I'm going to take you down to the valley, girl.
I'm going to take you all the way
down to the valley. And then I'm going to bring you back.
But I'm going to let you see
what the valley really looks like. When I woke up at Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized that the gates of hell had opened up and let me out. I don't remember asking to come here. I remember waking up here.
I don't remember
a lot that was said to me. I just knew that I was in a
room full of people who understood me.
Some had been farther down than me. Some had not been as down as me. But I knew I was in a room full of people that were in some shape or fashion
as much shit as I was.
And they were laughing about it. You know, I didn't have a car.
I had gotten drunk one time. I woke up.
So where's my car? And they said, you got drunk. You said you weren't going anywhere. I didn't have a car. I never knew that. I moved into St. Jude's, which back then the state paid for. Because I drug dealers don't have insurance. I went to a 28-day program there, and they said, I think we're going to make it 56 for you. So I got to stay 56 days. I got to stay at St. Jude's Halfway House, and that was not when they would allow you to stay for a year. At 5 months, when they told me it was time to go, I'm like, wait a minute, can we talk about this?
Because I was afraid. I was afraid to go
outside of the zone
of the safety that you people put around me. And when you say I will
love you until you can love yourself, that's really what you did with me. I was surrounded by a network of people who loved me and cared for me and cared what happened to me. And the thoughts of going back out in the world, because I only knew one kind of world.
you know, and it was not a very pretty one. I knew that the bar life was over for me. I knew that drugs were over for me, that alcohol was over for me, and that I had to get my life straightened out.
I couldn't remember my Social
Security number for 6 months,
and I had lost all my identification, so I was unemployable.
A friend of mine got me a job at Domino's Pizza on the sly. I don't know how she did it, but
she did.
And I rented a car from somebody else on $50 a week after I got my first paycheck. And I believe that my first job was delivering Domino's Pizza.
Here is this big drug deal.
You walk around with $10,000 and a little lizard cowboy boots delivering pizza. I was looking good. I didn't care. I came into this program, where I surrendered to this program on day one.
And I was sponsored by a man for a number of years. My name is Marion Banks, so you know him.
But one of the things that old son of a bitch said to me was, Roseanne, the deal is you got to buy the whole package. You got to buy the whole package, and you bought the whole package. I bought it all. Hook, line, and sinker. Everything y'all said. Everything you asked me to do, I did.
Every position
you told me to take, I took.
Every meeting you told me to go to, I went to.
You told me not to have relationships, sex, or anything the first year, I
like. Hello?
I didn't. I did what was asked of me because I didn't know what else to do. I had reached the end of the road. This was the last house on the block for me. Now, I'm going to tell you some good stuff. The Bluebirds have not pulled back the covers for me every day of my sobriety. Nor do I imagine they have yours. Because that's not life. You know, life on life's terms, I learned, can be lived without drugs and alcohol or any mood-altering substance. And it is possible to get through amazing tragedy and stay sober. It's also
possible to get through amazing victories and stay sober,
because you know I'm not. Look, I got drunk when it do hell. I got drunk when it bad. Didn't make a damn to me.
So it was important to me to learn how to stay sober when the times were good
and how to stay sober when the times were bad. I worked that pizza job and then I got me a cashier's job. My first car was a 1963 Petro station wagon. That three windows knocked out. I would have been sitting under an oak tree for 2 years. It smelled good, but it rained great. I didn't care because it was my car
and I could get to work.
Didn't have any heater in it, but I could get to work. You know, I can't tell you how grateful I was to just know that I was going to be okay.
Y'all were going to save me. This program
was going to save me. I believed every word you told me.
I'm going down Peachtree Street one night
and delivering pizzas, and I said to God, God, if this is what you want me to do for the rest of my life, my little fat ass will deliver pizzas from the day I die. 2 weeks later, I got a phone call and got another deal.
I'm ringing that cash register, and one day I say to God, you know what?
This is what you want me to do? I'll be the best cashier you've ever seen. 6 months later, I'm in Tampa, Florida, making $160,000 a year.
Whoa! How'd that happen?
And for 4 or 5 years, I mean, I lived a high life. I had a big house on Davis Island.
I'm flying everywhere.
Big, huge cars. So I always was a pretty smart girl. You know, just didn't have a lot of common sense. That lasted until 1991, and the company went bankrupt.
Well,
the company went bankrupt. Guess what? There goes the car. There goes the house. There goes Davis Island.
I come back to Atlanta.
I sent out 45,000, it felt like, resumes,
and everyone I got back said, you're overqualified.
You're overqualified. So, 90, my W-2 was 160,000, and 91, my W-2 was 25,000. It's all right. It's okay. You know what?
I didn't drink.
The thought of
drinking never occurred to me.
The thought of getting high never occurred to me. I thought, okay,
I guess this is what it's supposed to be.
I'm just grateful to be alive, because I shouldn't be alive the things I've done. You know, in 1993, my partner was diagnosed with lung cancer, and I buried her a year later, in December of 1994,
and I didn't drink.
And I didn't drug.
I went to meetings.
I used my network.
I was 8 years sober. And I said, it's...
I need to talk to my mama. I need to talk to my mama. So I called her. And I said, Mom, can I come talk to you? And she started crying. She said, you sure can. Very typical. My mother's got a third grade education. My daddy had a fifth. That didn't make any difference to me. I knock on the door, and the first thing my mother says is, honey, do you have AIDS? She said, well, I didn't know if I needed to spray the bathroom with a lifestyle.
I'm like, oh, yeah, that would have worked.
Good. That would have just solved everything. And I realized, because, see, the resume that left at 19 was not the resume that won. That's in there 8 years sober at 45. I realized, bless her heart, she doesn't know any better. And I said, no, ma'am, I don't. And I'm going to get you some
letter to so you'll understand that stuff better.
She said, okay, honey.
My mom and I
began an instant love affair that lasted for 4 years. My father never spoke a word to me. Not a word. My brother was still preaching. Over the course of that 4 years,
my mother became a
complete part of
my life in every area of my life.
She would ask me questions. Some I would answer, some I wouldn't.
She would come to Atlanta
and stay with me and just loved all my friends. Loved them. Loved to go to the coffee shop. Loved to go to the hamburger places. The most amazing thing happened during that 4 years. She was very ill. And one of the times that she was in the hospital, she said, I need to talk to you. Close the door.
I closed the door.
And she said, I need to tell you that we can love you. I was just amazed. Because, you know, I really thought maybe I had made this up in my head.
You know, that's a good
story to get people to feel sorry for you. Your mama don't love you. Here's my mother, and she said, we didn't love you. We really didn't want you. You were not a wanted child, and you weren't cared for. And I'm very sorry. We always cared more about your brother than we did you. I don't understand your lifestyle, but today I accept it. But I'm so sorry the way you were raised. I'm just a big old puddle on the floor, because I'm like, you know those times when you know God's in the room? You just know. He's just all over that room, because why in the world would my mother, right out of the blue, say those things? What it did was, there was a healing that occurred in me.
The healing was
that the things that I thought I knew and thought that I grew up knowing, I really didn't know. They were not things that I had manufactured in my head.
She
validated that. That my life really was what it was, but
all of a sudden,
that's just her simple words and the touch of her hand, it made it all right. But you know what?
She did the best she
could do. She was not equipped with a forefront education, married at 17, to accept a gay daughter.
Hello? I wouldn't have been either.
You know?
She was certainly not equipped to know anything about
me being a drug dealer or alcoholic, and thank God she didn't. But by her simply explaining, and then she said the most powerful thing. She said, I'm going to tell you why I today take better care of your brother than I do you, because
you're the stronger one.
And I knew you could make it. It's the greatest gift I've ever been given. That's the greatest gift. Because you see, folks, sobriety and life starts from within.
It doesn't come from within.
And to come from within, it has to come from above.
So if it comes from above, and it comes
from within, and then it comes out, then it's real. But if it comes any other direction, it's not real. I don't know how to tell you the sadness that I felt since I've been sober, and the joy. In 1996, in November, my father passed away. And I did all the right daughter things. Took my mother to the nursing home. It didn't matter
if he spoke to me or not.
And I did the right thing.
AA taught me that.
AA taught me and continues to teach me that no matter what, Rosemary, you do the right thing. Because people are looking at you.
Eyes
are watching you.
And you have a responsibility to carry the right message. So I did. He died in November, and my mother passed away a month and a half later. And a month and a half later is when I found out that I had been cut completely out of the will. My brother inherited $625,000, and I inherited $1,000. And that was to keep me from contesting the will. And you know what? I didn't drink. I didn't drug. I was okay. I cried. Not over the money. What I cried over was maybe not feeling that I had any roots. But it wasn't over the money. I don't know. I'm like Mae West. I've had money and I've lost money, you know. I like having it better than losing it, but you know, it comes and goes. I didn't drink through that. You know, I held my head up and I continued to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. 2001, I had been very sick for several years. In and out of the hospital all the time. 2001, the doctor walks me off the room. She said, "You're done. You can't work anymore." And I'm like, "Wait a minute. I don't know anything but how to take care of myself. No, I don't. No one's ever taken care of me." She said, "Well, you're done." I was diagnosed with congestive heart failure and COPD. I was diabetic.
I have degenerative joint disease. I have
osteoporosis. I have rheumatoid arthritis. Other than that, I'm in great shape. I didn't drink. It terrified me. What am I supposed to do? How do I do this? Took me 6 months before I got disability, and I thought, this is not the Rosemary I ever.
All I ever knew was, once I got sober,
was to work like a dog and take care of yourself. In 2004, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. Bluebirds didn't blow about the color that day either. Diagnosed with breast cancer, and 11 days later, they removed my right breast. And 10 days after that, I got something called MRSA, which some of you may know is a staph infection. And they gave me a 10% chance to live, and I'm like, "Don't bet against me! Trust me, after what I've already been through, don't bet against me!"
And sure enough, later, 8 months later,
I was in chemo, and I survived.
They put me on a moonback machine. I was in one room for 6 months.
But I never thought about drinking.
And I never thought about drinking.
Never.
Never, because that's just simply
not the answer.
Not the answer.
A relationship's not the answer. Sex is not the answer.
A drink
is not the answer. Money's not the answer. Drugs are not the answer. The answer for me is from a God of my understanding. That from the day he entered my life has never left. I have my concept of God,
and I do not question
anyone else's concept. Everyone's
entitled to their own.
The program tells me that. My Father is Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. I choose to believe that.
People can say,
"It's okay, believe what you want to, I don't care. Believe in a doorknob." That's what I believe in. But I believe that I am cared for on a daily basis by a very loving God. My God is this, is I have this image. That when I really need to, he's in this big huge chair, and he's this big gigantic soft fella,
and I crawl up in his lap.
He puts his arms around me, and he tells me, "It's going to be okay, Rosemary.
It's going to be okay."
Now, I've never seen that. Nobody ever went and came back and told me that, but that's what I choose to believe. I choose to believe that. I will
end with,
I always like to, you know, music has a huge impact in my life. And there's a song that's called "Fill My Cup, Lord." I lift it up, Lord. I mean, quench the thirsting of my soul.
Bread of heaven, feed me
till I want no more.
Fill my cup.
Fill it up. Make me whole. Tonight I will tell you that my cup not only is filled,
but I'm drinking all the saucer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rosie. Beautifully spoken.
The seventh tradition,
we have the bastards going around. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. Declining outside contributions, your donations support this group in AA's own. And I'd like to ask Tom to hand out the chips.
My name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic.
I've got a chip system here to mark
my time in sobriety. For anybody newer coming back, like to try this way of life one day at a time. Got a white chip? Anybody need to pick up a white chip today? 30 days, 30 much longer nights. Have a silver chip? 90 days, we have a red chip. Anybody need a red chip? Six months, have a yellow chip. 9 months, green chip. And for years and multiples thereof, we have a blue chip. Anybody have an AA birthday today?
I guess I did.
I've been picking up chips since Thursday. Oh, no, since Friday. Friday was my actual birthday. And my name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. So. And this is year three. And I did it by picking up a white chip. My sister brought me here when I asked her for help. I said, "What can I do?" And she brought me to this very room. And it was a speaker's meeting. And it was that night, the speaker that we had last week was telling his story, and we had a history, and I hadn't seen him in 20, 30 years. And it was one of those moments that you just couldn't deny it, and I had to pick up that chip. But it was a process. It wasn't easy, and I got involved. I worked the steps. I picked up I requested sponsorship by a man that was just the right guy for me. And he's not here tonight. He will be here next week. So I won't go into a long story, but I guess the bulk of my work is here at the speaker's meeting. And you guys, you're the reason I'm sober today. Thank you very much.
Okay, it's time for
AA announcements. We got in? Hey, Mark.
My name is Mark, an alcoholic.
That's right.
About this coming weekend, the weekend after, is making assemblies. Anybody that's involved in the anybody can know more about how many funds. The service director of AA will be there. They won't kick you out, they won't make you leave. You just don't get the votes. You just stare at them and take classes and learn.
Okay. Now, is there anybody in the room that knows anything about the event in Athens is coming up in the next few weeks? I don't know anything about it, but...
Oh, is that what it is?
Okay. The last 3 days of October. Be sure you sign up tomorrow. Okay. Well, next week, we've got Beth H. telling her story. She's a member of the NAVA Bridge Builders Group. And the week after that, Annie B. has promised to make it and tell her story again here. And so that's a good lineup. We've got a strong roster of fine sober ladies. And thank you, Rosemary, again. That was great. And thank all the people who read tonight. And if there's nothing else, we'll close the meeting. I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
What is that?
Hey, Jeff, would you take us out, please?
Yeah, I mean, that's all.